This is Fresh Air. Anna Quindlen was the third woman ever to have a column on the op-ed page of the New York Times. She often writes about issues of particular significance to women. In her column called Public and Private, she covers the personal and the political. There's a new collection of her columns called Thinking Out Loud. Her previous New York Times column, Life in the 30s, was very personal, focusing on her life as a mother. Her editors convinced her to write it after she had decided to leave the paper to raise her children. So you can imagine that daycare is an important issue to her. When Kimba Wood and Zoe Baird were taken out of the running for the position of attorney general because they had hired undocumented nannies, Anna Quindlen wrote a column about what working women looking for childcare are up against. She, too, had hired an undocumented worker to care for her children. She told me why.
I looked over my files from the last time I interviewed somebody for a job helping me take care of our kids, which was about 4 years ago. And 11 people responded to my ad. And of those 11, one of them was an American citizen who actually has been working for several years for a friend of mine. But the very best one was a young woman who was in this country to marry an American citizen, but who herself was here on a visitor's visa from Ireland. I hired her. She now has a green card. We have totally paid any back taxes, which we owed, which was not very much because about a year and a half ago, she wanted to go on the books with us so that she and her husband could look toward buying a house. So that she was obviously the very best person to look after our kids, still is. But we didn't hear from very many American citizens at all. And as I said in one of my columns, I think that's because many of the women who interview for those jobs come from countries in which caring for kids for a living is kind of an honored profession. And in the United States, it's not.
I think there's a lot of baggage that comes into things when you hire someone to work in your home, whether it's to help raise your children or to clean the house. And I think there's just like a lot of very complicated class and often racial issues that enter into that. And I wonder if you've felt any ambivalence or discomfort at having somebody, you know, hired working in your home.
I haven't felt any ambivalence, except that I'm always keenly aware that this isn't really an employer-employee relationship, not only because Elaine works in our home, but because, given the fact that she helps care for my children, she's something in between a family member and someone who works with us. So that there are certain issues that arise in terms of her health and happiness and well-being that don't always arise in a standard employer-employee relationship. And I have to always be conscious of the peculiar middle ground which she inhabits. But she likes working with us very much. She's expecting her own child soon that we consider sort of half our baby. And she expects after her maternity leave to come back with her own baby to help take care of my three, which I think will be very good for her, very good for my kids, and very good for her kid.
And you feel confident that she feels that kind of family feelings about you that you feel about her. Because I think one of the fears, and again, this is getting to the kind of like class ambivalence that a lot of people feel, is that you can feel very familial toward the person that you're hiring, but they might feel like, well, not the same feelings, that they're the hired hand.
I don't think that our childcare person feels that way, mainly because we treat her really decently and we pay her a living wage.
I want to bring up another subject that you've often written about in your column, and that's the issue of abortion. What went through your mind when David Gunn, the doctor who worked at the abortion clinic in Florida, was murdered?
I was completely and totally unsurprised because, given the reporting that I've done over the last 2 years, given the level of escalating violence against clinics and escalating harassment of clinic workers, and given, quite frankly, the extent to which my mail has escalated in terms of violence of expression and hatred. There was something inside me that said, of course, and I'm sorry to be able to say that.
What kind of mail do you get when you write a column about abortion?
I get horrible hate mail. I get pictures. I get material suggesting that I'm not fit to be a mother. I get material that's filled with sexual suggestions, which is something I have yet to figure out. I just get horrible, horrible stuff. You know, we get packages sometimes from people, and it's very disheartening because I can't tell you with what joy I grab onto a thoughtful, reasoned, intelligent letter from someone saying, this is why I think abortion should be illegal, because the vast majority of the mail I get on that issue is just horrid and doesn't add anything to human understanding, and I ought to add that it is almost unvaryingly for men.
My guest is New York Times columnist Anna Quinlan. She has a new collection of columns called Thinking Out Loud. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. New York Times columnist Anna Quinlan is my guest. You were brought up Catholic. Are you still involved with the church?
Yes. My children have all been baptized, and we're educating them in Catholic doctrine, and our eldest receives the sacraments, and so do my husband and I.
Mm-hmm. And it's important to you to have the whole family still be involved.
Very important. Very important. I don't think there's anybody better for my children to learn from about how to face the world than what's in the New Testament, because it teaches as well as I ever could about loving both those who are your brothers and your friends and loving those who are different than you are and who might be ostracized by the rest of society. And that's really what I want my kids to know.
Have you ever written a column that has alienated the people who otherwise see you as the good guy, as being on their side?
I'm not sure I have in terms of the column I'm doing now. I suppose the closest I would have come is the recent column in which I talked about the overturning of the conviction of Kelly Michaels, who was convicted 5 years ago of having sexually abused children in the daycare center where she worked, because there are a number of people who are my sort of natural constituency who believe passionately that she's innocent and was railroaded, and I'm not convinced of that. So that might be the one, since I've been writing this column. When I was doing Life in the 30s, it was most clearly the column I wrote about deciding not to have amniocentesis when I was pregnant with our third child, because many of our readers felt that it was an anti-choice column.
What were your reasons for not wanting amniocentesis?
Because my husband and I had made the decision that no matter what the amnio told us about the condition of the fetus, that we intended to go through with the pregnancy. And therefore, there didn't seem to be a real compelling reason to take the very slight risk of miscarriage involved in amnio to find out something that would not change our attitude toward the pregnancy.
Did people not want to give you the right to be pro-choice, yet decide that you didn't want to have an abortion yourself?
I think that people thought that I was advocating this for other people, when in fact what I was trying to say about amnio is that in some sense it has no longer been a choice. It is taken for granted that you're going to have it. And without, in some cases, enough information both about that slight risk of miscarriage and about the limitations of what it can tell you. I've had women tell me that because they had amnio, they know that their baby is healthy, when in fact it reveals a fairly limited range of defects in the fetus, and it cannot tell you often how bad those defects are. So that, for example, it can tell you that you're going to have a child who has Down syndrome, but it can't tell you whether that child will be moderately, severely, or mildly retarded. And I think for some people, that would really affect their decision. So I think doctors have to be much better about filling women in, not only about what amnio does, but about what it can't do. I don't feel that many of them are doing that as much as needs to be done, or were doing it when I was pregnant with Maria 5 years ago. And finally, we just felt that it was not necessary because we were going to go ahead no matter what the amnio told us.
What surprised you most about the type of response you got to that column?
I think two things were surprising to me. One was how clearly some people had misread it, and the other was the depth of despair and anger among people who had grown up with a disabled sibling and felt that sibling had basically taken over their family's lives. I received any number of letters from people who had a brother or a sister who had Down syndrome, for example, and said that they felt that they never had any sort of fair share of their parents' time and had huge responsibilities as the years went on because of that sibling, and that I couldn't possibly understand what that was like.
That's very interesting. I'm surprised that that's what you got. I wasn't expecting you to say that.
It really was sort of staggering. And then after I had Maria, I got several letters from women who were pregnant at the same time I was, didn't have amnio for many of the same reasons that I didn't, and did, in fact, have babies with Downs, and that was very, very difficult.
So did they say they were sorry they didn't have it?
Some did, and others said no, that they loved their baby, and that they were deeply offended when people said to them, well, didn't you have the test? And so the obvious answer would have been, well, if you would have had the test, you wouldn't be stuck with this child. I'm now on the board of the National Down Syndrome Society, and it's mainly because of all I learned and all I felt needed to be done after having written that column.
Huh. I want to ask you a little bit about your family. Your mother died when you were 19 years old. Was that sudden? Had she been ill?
No, it wasn't sudden. My mother died of ovarian cancer. It was about a year and a half from her diagnosis to her death.
Were you very close with her?
She was my mother in every sense of the word. I couldn't have possibly asked for a better one. And I actually was at home with her for the last 5 months of her illness, so it was a really painful time. I miss her terribly.
You were in college then?
Yes, so I took a year off from college when my mother was dying, and then right afterward.
So you had been out of town at Barnard College?
Yes, I came home.
Right. What were you going through in your life after her death that you just especially wanted her around for?
Well, I think there are clearly times, and it sounds so silly, when you just want your mom. When I was planning my wedding, I wanted my mother. And when I was having my babies, I really wanted my mother. And now that I have them, I feel that it's so sad that they don't know her, because she would have been such an extraordinary grandmother. But I think more than that, it's as though you lose a crucial grounding in your life. I mean, in the most profound and obvious way, your mother is where you come from. And when that's gone, you really have to find a way to be a fully independent person. In a sense, it's very scary when you're young.
Are there times when you see mothers and daughters together that make you particularly think about her?
Yeah. I mean, real, real little times. It's difficult for me when my friends are with their mothers and they're fighting with them, because there's part of me that wants to say, don't you appreciate what you have? It's difficult for me when I'll see, you know, a mother and daughter just out to lunch together doing real ordinary things. That still bothers me a little bit. To be perfectly honest with you, I think some of the curse is off of it now because I have children of my own. And so some of the things I would like to have done with my mother, I can do with them.
Right. I want to ask you about your Pulitzer.
A year ago today.
Did you say you won that a year ago today? So today's actually the anniversary.
Yes, I know that because it's the day before my wedding anniversary.
Oh, gosh.
Tomorrow's my 15th wedding anniversary. And Jerry and I were planning on going out to dinner the night before anyhow, but we just took along a whole mess of friends.
How did they let you know? They call you up? Or did your newspaper find out?
Western Union calls and reads a telegram over the telephone to you at 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Honest. I didn't make that up. I know it sounds like it's in a bad novel.
Or movie, yeah.
Yeah, they read you this telegram that tells you that you've won the Pulitzer.
And did you say thank you very much, or did you let out a little yelp?
I cried. Actually, and
oh, even more like that novel or movie.
Yeah, I couldn't help it. It's one of those moments that you want to freeze in time because it seems so improbable. But I was very, very happy, at least as much because I knew how incredibly happy it would make my father as for any other reason.
Well, Anna Quinlan, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Anna Quinlan writes the New York Times column Public and Private. A new collection of her columns has just been published. It's called Thinking Out Loud. This is Fresh Air.